Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Andrew McDermott. Are life and the universe a mindless accident? What does the science say? A new book from Discovery Institute Press called Evolution and Intelligent Design in a Nutshell aims to take a close yet accessible look at the latest scientific evidence, from the smallest cell to the farthest reaches of the universe, to reveal the full story of life's origin and development. Today on the show, I'm joined by one of the co-authors of this new book, Eric Anderson. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Andrew. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. Well, you work in the technology space and have some engineering background. I see here that you also practiced law for several years, working with some of the leading software and technology companies in Silicon Valley. You're also a design theorist and an author on evolution and intelligent design. That's a unique mix. Tell us about your background a little and how you became interested in the origin of life.
Sure. So I like to say that I started life as a computer programmer many years ago, taught myself COBOL and Fortran, and even dabbled around quite a bit with the Apple IIs and BASIC, although you're not supposed to admit that as a computer programmer. And then eventually went and studied languages and linguistics and ended up in law school. So kind of lost that track of my engineering side, I guess, a little bit, but practiced overseas and in Silicon Valley with several major law firms, working with some of the key technology and software companies in the world. And then a few years ago, I returned to my engineering roots, so to speak, and I'm helping to manage technology and software startups, working with some systems design analysis, major project requirements, and things like that. So it's been an interesting journey and an interesting mix of background there.
Sure. Now, let me play the devil's advocate for a moment, because I anticipate what our detractors are going to be looking at here. You don't have a degree in biochemistry. Why should we take your argument seriously? Wouldn't it be better to talk to a PhD biochemist?
So, first of all, it's not about me. It doesn't matter whether I'm the president of the National Academy of Sciences or somebody off the street. What you need to do is look at the argument, analyze the argument, look at the evidence. If somebody has a refutation to my argument, great, let's hear it. If they don't, and I've made a solid case, then welcome aboard. Second, I'm not a lone voice crying in the wilderness. There are lots and lots of PhD scientists who are very skeptical about the evolution story generally, about origin of life specifically, and they have put out a lot of good arguments and a lot of good analysis of the evidence. There are biologists, biochemists, mathematicians, embryologists, historians of science, lots of people who have very serious doubts about the story. So I'm trying to put forward an argument and make a unique contribution in my own right. But the other thing that I am also doing is trying to bring to bear some of the arguments of these, you know, many accomplished PhD scientists and other professionals who have concerns about what's going on in this area of research. Third, I would say, have you heard the story of the emperor's clothes?
Sure.
The children's story. So my mom used to read that to me when I was young. And sometimes we need an outsider to come in and spot problems and identify things. In my background, in the work that I've done over the years, nobody likes an audit, of course. But sometimes it's necessary to bring in an outsider who doesn't have a stake in the outcome, who isn't professionally interested in the outcome, to come in, look at issues, whether that's a financial audit or a legal audit or a technical audit, and say, hey, this doesn't look right. This looks a little bit fishy. What can we do here to determine what's actually going on? Philip Johnson, of course, made a tremendous contribution to the debate over evolution and intelligent design as an attorney, by being able to come in, analyze the arguments, look at the underlying assumptions, and start asking the right questions. I'm not suggesting that I'm in Philip Johnson's category necessarily, other than the fact that we have similar background and similar interest in origins. But the point is, there's some value in having an outsider sometimes come in and push and ask the right questions. And, you know, if I'm not invited up on the stage in front of the crowd to put on the lab coat and make claims about origin of life, that's fine. I can be the lad at the back of the crowd who raises his hand and shouts, hey, the emperor has no clothes. And I think that's a useful contribution.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then last of all, and I think this is really important for people to understand, origin of life and self-replication, which is what I'm focusing on in chapter 3 of the book, is not primarily about biochemistry. There's a real lack of careful analysis and evaluation of the claims being made. And to be blunt, a lot of the origin of life researchers have really not thought through the issues carefully, because they're seduced with this idea that if we can just get the right chemistry, if we can just get the right molecules in the test tube, then we've got it solved. And I argue that's just barking up the wrong tree. James Tour, who's one of the world's leading synthetic chemists, wrote an essay last year in which he mentioned with some frustration that when he talks to Origin of Life researchers about the many practical problems with the origin of life, he gets, you know, just a blank stare. And it's not just that they don't have answers, but much worse, they often haven't even considered the issues. And so if you're under the impression that self-replication is about getting the right molecules in the test tube, then I think you're on the wrong track. And lastly, I would say, and I hope this doesn't come across as arrogant or dismissive, because there's so much good work that's being done in the field of biochemistry by many dedicated researchers. But if you want something that's going to be built with physical materials and is going to function in the real world, in real time, in three-dimensional space, that's a problem of engineering. And of course, if we want to build a biochemical system of that nature, then we need biochemistry and we need the wisdom and the genius of all the world's best biochemists. But self-replication is not fundamentally about biochemistry. It's about control systems and logic and causal closure and feedbacks and information processing and regulatory networks and engineering. And so ironically, a broad background in many of these areas, logic and information processing and programming and those kinds of things, coupled with some careful analysis, will do a lot more toward getting the right answer in this area than just a narrow focus on biochemistry, particularly if the latter comes with some of the intellectual baggage that says, hey, there just must be an answer to the origin of life in self-replication in simple chemistry. So we're just going to put on the blinders and go full bore trying to get a simple self-replicator without really stepping back to analyze the big picture. So that's a long answer, but that's what I would say to somebody who's trying to focus only on biochemistry in this area.
Sure. Yeah, no, I like the thoroughness of your answer. I like some of the points you make. Don't take anyone's word for it in particular. And sometimes you do need an outsider to point out issues and identify things that need further scrutiny. And like you said, you do have this problem of engineering, and a lot of folks just steer away from that and try to look for the biochemistry, but you do need it all. You need a careful analysis of all of it. So the two chapters you wrote focus on the origin of life. Why include a chapter about the origin of life in a book about evolution? You know, some would say that the origin of life is a separate issue and that evolutionary theory doesn't have to deal with that. What would you say to that?
So this is actually a misconception and I guess a disconnect between what I would call the popular public debating strategy versus what's going on in the actual research. It is common to hear in debates over these issues, in particular debates about evolution, that, hey, we don't have to deal with origin of life because that's a separate topic. The reason for that, there are probably multiple reasons actually, but one of the reasons for that is origin of life has long been recognized as the soft underbelly of the materialist creation story. There are many people who feel like, hey, once we have an organism on hand, you know, Darwin gave us a good explanation of what happens next, so we've got that well in hand. I disagree with that, but that's kind of the view. But virtually everybody recognizes that origin of life is an incredibly challenging and thorny issue. And so what has happened over the years in the debate is if someone is talking about evolution or questioning the overall materialist creation story and they bring up origin of life, it's often common to hear, well, that's a separate topic. We don't have to deal with that. However, what's going on in the research is very different. Starting with the recognition that happened many years ago and is continuing of what's required for a living cell and the remarkable complexity and integrated systems and information that's required, everybody recognizes that a living cell is not going to arise by chance on the earth. Even the most diehard materialist recognizes that. And so nobody is expecting chance to be able to produce a living organism. Instead, what they've done is push it back. And there have been lots of attempts over the years. Should we focus on metabolism? Should we focus on, you know, the membrane? Should we focus on DNA? And at this point, we're basically back to the smallest possible thing that people can think of that could have potentially worked. And that's essentially a self-replicating molecule. And so the thought is, once we get a self-replicating molecule to arise by chance, which should be, the thinking goes, far easier than getting a whole cell, right? Once we get that self-replicating molecule, then Darwinian evolution will kick in to build the first cell, to build the first organism. And it's very clear now in the Origin of Life research and in listening to the key people in this area that Darwinian evolution is not only relevant to the origin of life, it's absolutely essential to it. They are 100% counting on Darwinian evolution to be able to take this hypothetical simple self-replicator and turn it into the first living organism.
Eric, in the book, you seem to be drawing a comparison between spontaneous generation and abiogenesis. Now, some critics might take issue with this comparison. First, can you define these two terms for listeners who are unfamiliar with them? And then, to play a devil's advocate again, are you arguing that the two are identical?
So, sure, to define them initially, the idea of spontaneous generation, which has been around for centuries, millennia actually, is the idea that certain organisms, typically small organisms, could arise from non-living matter spontaneously. And so, you know, the ancients would look at a barrel of wheat, and sure enough, eventually you'd see mice. Or they'd look at some rotting meat, and sure enough, eventually you would see maggots or worms emerging from the mud bank. And so there was an idea that if the conditions were just right, then non-living matter could give rise to these small organisms. Abiogenesis is the idea that life comes from non-life, A meaning not, and bio, of course, referring to life, and genesis meaning originating. So abiogenesis literally means life from non-life. And I'm not necessarily arguing that these are identical. It's clear that modern abiogenesis proponents don't think that mice arose from a barrel of wheat or worms from the mud bank. That's not the case at all. But there's a very striking parallel between this idea of spontaneous generation that we would laugh at now because of our current scientific understanding and the idea of abiogenesis that's being proposed now in Origin of Life research. And if you think back to sort of the fundamental conception behind the two, it's really about the same, which is, hey, this isn't something that happens often. It's not something that necessarily happens easily. But if we can just get the right conditions, if only we get things in just the right way, then non-life can give rise to life. And so the reason I draw that parallel, again, is not necessarily to equate them 100%, but because we should pause and sit back when we're hearing the claims that we hear today and say, wait a minute, we've been down this path before, and it seemed like there was some evidence to support it, and now it turns out that there wasn't evidence to support it. And so I'm just urging the same caution with the current claims of abiogenesis.
Okay. Now, I'd like to bring intelligent design into this a little bit here as we wrap up for today. The first of your two chapters focuses on the information problem facing the origin of life. Can you summarize that problem for our listeners? For some, it might seem a little confusing. We're talking about a tiny one-celled organism, the proposed first life on Earth. How much information could something that tiny need? And where does intelligent design come into it?
Sure. So as we have learned more over the years about what it takes to have a living cell and all of the information that's required, both in DNA as well as in the actual structure in epigenetics that tell the DNA how to be used, when to be used, what to produce, how to produce it, there's a lot of information processing that's going on in even the smallest organism. Steve Meyer has done a fantastic job in his book, Signature in the Cell, in bringing out this argument in great detail, so I won't delve into it deeply here. But the point is, the amount of information that's required for even the humblest cell is very significant. We don't know how much, but we're starting to get a decent sense of the lower bound of what's required. Researchers have used what's called knockout experiments, where they essentially try to disable certain genes or remove pieces of DNA or prevent them from being expressed. and have discovered that for a self-replicating organism that is a parasite, we're looking at something in the neighborhood of 300 genes. And again, it's relying on its host for some of the things that it needs to survive. For a free-living cell, we're probably talking more in the neighborhood of about 600 genes. That's a massive amount of information that has just virtually no chance of coming about in a naturalistic sense by chance. It's just not going to happen. And so this is why abiogenesis tries to rely upon the Darwinian mechanism to build the first simple cell. They realize that it can't come about by chance. And so hopefully we can get something like a self-replicating molecule, and then we'll rely on Darwin to build the first organism for us. The reason why the information is important is, of course, as Steve pointed out in his book and as many others have pointed out, is that in our uniform and repeated experience, information always comes from a mind. It doesn't come from a purely natural materialistic process. It always comes from a mind. And so when we see information in life, we should ask ourselves, what do we make of that?
Right. Can't take these things for granted. Well, that's all the time we have for today, but in another episode, we'll discuss the second chapter you contributed to this book, which focuses on the problem of creating a self-replicating entity. Thanks for your time, Eric.
You bet. Glad to be here.
You can grab a copy of Evolution and Intelligent Design in a Nutshell at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, BN.com, and other online retailers. Listen to more episodes of ID the Future at IDTheFuture.com or anywhere podcasts can be found. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and IDTheFuture.com.